Living Room Logic.
Welcome back to another episode of Living Room Logic. And this week we're going to be talking to a NASA researcher, which is going to be absolutely exciting. So to be honest, I think I just want to fly into it. Dr. Quivaroon, do you want to just briefly introduce yourself and what you do?
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me. I am a NASA scientist. At the minute, I'm working at NASA Ames in California, where I'm looking at planets outside of our solar system. So these planets are called exoplanets. They're very, very far away, so we can't actually go there and study them. You can't send probes there or rockets there the way you could things in our solar system. So the way we try to understand these planets is through looking at the telescopes, looking at the data received from the telescopes and trying to understand this data. So that's where I come in. I'm a mathematician, so I spend a lot of my time making models for this data, for how a planet might look to the telescope. And that's what I've been doing for the last 2.5 years. Since I finished my PhD.
That's crazy. And it's such a impressive thing to be doing immediately after a PhD, to just immediately jump into like some of the biggest things on Earth. And it has been recognized, to be fair, because what caught my eye looking around was that you were part of the Forbes 30 Under 30. I'm sure it's a little weird even for you to kind of think about, because it's such a phenomenal and absolutely deserved achievement. And like, how was that experience when that came out? Was it a little surreal?
It definitely was, because they didn't tell us until the list was published. So the day I found out was the day everyone found out. So I sort of woke up to like, there was a lot happening on LinkedIn. And I was a bit, what's going on here? And I checked all of that before I even checked my own email. So by the time I found out, it had sort of spread a bit further afield. So it was definitely a bit of a surprise, and you know, it hasn't quite sunk in. Although I'm heading in a couple of weeks, hopefully heading to Detroit for a summit with some of the other 30 under 30 listers. So I'd say that might hopefully be when it sinks in a wee bit, when I get to be a part of something like that.
It's such a huge recognition of clearly so much hard work. And like, it's more recognition of achievement. It's not achievement. It's look at everything. This all this amazing, cool stuff you've done. Like immediately working at NASA following your PhD must be wild. And out of just, was that always the goal? Were you always thinking, right, I'm going to make my way to NASA eventually, and that you're so interested in space? But you're a mathematician, so was your interest always in space, or was it somewhere else initially?
Initially, I really had no idea. I was just doing maths, because I always loved space, and space is always something that fascinated me ever since I was a child. But I didn't know I could do anything with it. I sort of, when I was growing up, I knew about NASA, but I understood you had to be an American citizen to work for NASA. So I'd sort of ruled that out from a young age. And I didn't know enough about any of the sort of European space initiatives that were taking place closer to home. So it was something I was always like, that's really cool, but not really an option for me. But I just kept studying maths because I love maths. And the further through I got my maths education and I started doing my PhD, and then I realized that I could work there as a research scientist, and I could apply a lot of the mathematical modeling techniques that I'd picked up along the way were applicable to a whole range of different scientific disciplines, not just space, but space being the one that interested me the most. So it really wasn't actually until I was doing my PhD that I started to seek out those opportunities and realize that they were options. So I got quite lucky in the end, really finding that position so soon after the PhD and being able to take my maths and apply it. And that was really down to my supervisor, Professor Mark Marley. He really took on board my skills and sort of the different perspective I would bring as a mathematician, and was able to bring me on board to a team of astrophysicists. So a bit of a switch.
God, but like, as much as that might be a few things coming together, it's still so earned. You know, there's so much hard work that goes in long before you can get lucky in this scenario. You know what I mean? So this was all going on. You just had a passion for maths, and you went to Trinity, did you, for maths?
I did my undergrad at Trinity, yeah. And then my PhD was at the University of Oxford.
As you do. Was that the plan? Were you always were you just thinking to do a PhD, or was there something that caught your eye in Oxford?
No, when I was coming to the end of my bachelor's, the end of my undergrad, I just wasn't really finished learning maths. Our undergrad, the Trinity undergrad, was quite broad. We got a little bit of a lot of subjects, would be the way to put it. You kind of got to touch on a lot of different maths. So when I was coming out of it, I still just felt like there was more I could do. I could hone in on something a bit deeper, which is why then I chose to do a PhD. And the program at Oxford was quite unique. It was called Industrially Focused Mathematical Modeling. So it was very applied. All of the projects, there was 13 in my cohort, all of our PhD projects were sponsored by companies with real world industrial problems that we were tasked with solving using maths, all while trying to write up a mathematical thesis. So there's always a bit of a balance between trying to produce something the company wants and trying to write something that'll get you a PhD. So that it was quite a unique opportunity, and it was a great way to take the maths and apply it in a way that was actually benefiting a company or benefiting people, and not just being quite so abstract, which people often think maths can be abstract or isn't useful or those sort of things. So it was a great way to really use maths for good.
Yeah, and I can absolutely imagine, like, my own perception of a lot of mathematics is, as you're constantly figuring things out, you can't be certain where exactly it can always be applied, but then suddenly it is applied, and suddenly It is very useful. And like, there's always that conversation around like things that NASA would be doing and things in the 60s and 70s, and especially in that crossover between like mathematics and engineering, where when you're trying to solve one problem, it may take you 1,000 tries to get it right, but in the process, you'll solve 999 problems just by accident. Someone will say, oh, actually, that thing we did, that'll be useful here. Exactly. And I feel like maths is very much like that. Mm-hmm. So you were in Oxford and you were doing your PhD, and I'm so excited for you to tell me how wrong I am. But what I picked up on from briefly looking at your thesis, which was a lot, it was a lot for my poor biologist mind. It was an awful lot, though. The introduction and abstract was very lovelily written for someone like me, so thank you very much. But what I was getting was that a lot of what you were doing was predicting how particles move and predicting how they move in different environments and under different stresses and under different things, which in my head is quite a chaotic thing to be trying to predict, whether you're talking about food in a blender or if you're talking about the formation of planets in the universe. There's an awful lot of factors, my gosh, to actually bring into this. Could you tell me more about specifically what you were doing in your PhD, and then we'll make the dance over to how that then comes into what you're doing at NASA, at least?
Yeah, so you're close with the particles. So the blender particles, absolutely right. I did a short project with a blender company where we tried to understand how a blade would chop food in a blender to make a smooth smoothie, and how you could optimize that whole mechanism to try and get the smoothest smoothie possible without having the loudest blender possible or a blender that uses all the energy. That was a lot more moving particles. Whereas my PhD, it had a particulate component. It was looking at furnaces of carbon particles, of, you know, bits of coal. But I didn't focus so much on them moving, which would have been a part of the problem, but it's just quite a big problem. So the problem that the bit that I honed in on was how these particles conducted electricity. So the way a furnace works, a metallurgical furnace, it'll be a big vessel and you fill it full of stuff. And then you've got an electrode at the top and an electrode at the bottom, typically. And what will happen is they'll pass a current between those two electrodes. The current will conduct through whatever material you've got in the furnace. And in doing so, will manipulate that material in some way. So the particular furnace I was looking at was called a calciner. The material inside it was particulate carbon, so bits of coal. And as the current passed through that coal, it heated up. And in particular, it heated up at its little contact points where all of the particles touched each other. And you get quite a lot of heating in particular at those small points. And as the carbon heats up, the material properties of it start to change and it starts to resemble something a bit more like graphite, which is more desirable within the metallurgy industry. They want to get something like graphite because it's very conductive and it's a good material to have. So the issue, though, for the company was they have these big furnaces and they know if they put carbon in it and they turn it on, they'll get something out the bottom. But they just didn't know exactly what happened inside because they got very hot.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance.
United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
They got, you know, over 1,000 degrees Celsius they could reach, and you can't really just, you know, stick a spade in there and take out a little sample. Mm-hmm. So they relied on models and simulations to try and understand how that current exactly was heating the material and what that heating was doing to the particles. So that's where the math sort of came in to try and understand that. And then the biggest challenge with that was these furnaces are huge, but the particles are tiny. So when you're trying to do mathematical models, you have these vast discrepancies in the two scales you're considering. You have to apply some tricks to get something that's sort of computationally tractable. So I think you can solve on a computer in a reasonable length of time. So that's where I come in.
So it's pretty necessary as well when you're looking at this, that since it's within this closed system, it's in this system that you can't get. It's in this place that you can't check. You really depend on predicting what's going on. Like you're almost completely dependent on it because you can't get to it. So I can see how that would be very, very useful for looking inside of an environment that is so close, but you can't touch it, as well as maybe in what you're doing now, which is an environment that is so far that you can't always look at exactly what's going on. So it makes a lot of sense like that, how there is a crossover. And how there is the skill that you have is that you can see things that we can't look at. You can predict things that we can't look at. And is that, again, is that roughly along the right lines of what's going on?
Yeah, 100%. You've got something that you might not be able to physically touch and put your hands on will still be underpinned by some sort of mathematical equation. There's always a way that you can take something physical and put it on paper in the form of equations, of physics principles, of all those things. So if you can break a problem down into those components, you can do a lot with just the math, and you can really understand quite complex processes by just looking at the math that underpins it.
And in that, so I'm assuming with these models that you're making, you can kind of train them and tune them based off of lots and lots of results, which I'm sure with a furnace and things like that, you might be able to see the outcome because it's, let's say, for example, it's a shorter process than the formation of exoplanets, for example. So I'm imagining with the furnace, you could kind of fine tune it and you could say, oh, we thought this would happen, but this would happen. Let's fill in the next thing, which brings us next to NASA, which I can imagine is that's something you don't have the luxury of having, the before and after. You just have what's in front of you. How do you even approach that? That sounds, I'm assuming that's a big problem. Is it a big problem?
It's a challenge. So the planets that we're looking at, you know, the discovery of exoplanets is just accelerating. With the more telescopes we put up there, especially now with the James Webb telescope, there's just, we're actually getting more data than we have models for. So previously we wouldn't have really had, maybe the models wouldn't have been up to scratch, and they're really still not quite up to scratch due to the limitations we have in really understanding how these planets behave. But the way we would try and check a model and check what we're doing is to compare it with this data that we're getting from planets. So the more that we're getting back from the telescopes, the more refined these models are becoming. The bigger issue, aside from just validating your models, the bigger issue is just how complex these environments are and our limited understanding really of how they behave, because we only really have Earth as a reference point. You know, if we look at, I look a lot at clouds around planets. So the only cloud we know are water clouds, but clouds on other planets could be made of anything. They could be made of iron. They could be made of sulfur. They could be made of, you know, there's planets that apparently have clouds made of carbon and it rains diamonds. So you have all of these different kinds of physics that we're really just having a go at and saying, well, we think this is how this would behave. And based on the chemical properties of this element, we'd imagine clouds are like this. There's a lot of uncertainty in the models that we're creating. So you kind of have to think about that. You don't really want to delve down too deep into something that could be completely wrong. Mm. So it's sort of a balance between getting that physics and getting the technical components in there and all of those intricacies and everything that we know should be happening in a planet, but also balancing it with how much of this is uncertain? How much of this is just a guess? Because you need to kind of have a good balance between detail and your limitations. So a lot of the models that we're making will simplify them quite a lot and, you know, focus on some components of atmosphere. So for example, when you think about how a cloud forms, you have these little particles and they'll start to condense, vapor will condense into, in our case, water, but on the planets could be anything. And these things start to coagulate and they get bigger and they grow and they move and they do all sorts of things. Trying to put all of that into one model just becomes extremely difficult. So we might just strip that down and say, well, let's just think about the condensation part. Let's just focus on that element and see what we come up with and see how good a model is with just this one factor. How good is it at predicting? If it's not great, it probably won't be because there's not very much. You start to add in some more bits. So it's kind of a process. So kind of what you said, let's go back and forth. This did well, this didn't. You're still doing the same thing. So you always start with something simple and try and build in more complex components. And as our database gets bigger, which it is, we'll be able to build in more and more and hopefully get good models in the end. But so it's an exciting process because, you know, you've got the freedom to kind of think outside the box and think, will this be a good addition? Or maybe we could take that thing out. And yeah.
Yeah, like forget the freedom to think outside the box. There's the demand. You have to completely throw the toys out of the pram and say every assumption, every instinct you have is probably not how it works. Because, we'd be focusing so many of our instincts on just things going on Earth and you're looking at something alien, literally something so outside of it that we have to just bring it back and go, oh, what if it does rain sulfur? And what if that's mixing with other things going on and pulling?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I can only imagine the headaches that come across with that all of the time. When you're looking at that, would you be looking, so we were using like clouds, for example, but would you be looking at clouds, like things that are going on exoplanets, or would you also be looking at things like the formation of exoplanets as well?
I'm primarily looking at exoplanets that exist. So the clouds that are forming and how they impact the spectra that we get back from a planet. So why I'm most interested in clouds is that they can be very problematic when you look at a planet. So if you point a telescope out in space and it's getting data back from these planets, the telescope is detecting light from the planet. That's how the telescope works. And then you'll break that light down into what we call the spectra, which is basically, it's like a rainbow. You split it up into its different wavelengths and you look at how much light, the intensity of light at every wavelength. So what you'll get is this sort of graph, which is with lots of peaks and troughs and what we call atmospheric features. And those features will tell you a bit about if there's oxygen, if there's carbon, what sort of elements are in that planet or in that atmosphere to have scattered the light in the way that the telescope detected it. So the problem with clouds is that sometimes clouds can just mask the atmosphere completely. So with the light coming off the planet, the light reflected off the planet or whatever into the telescope, isn't actually capturing all of those features because the clouds are hiding them. So you want to understand clouds and you want to try and understand how they form and how thick they are and different things about them to be able to factor those into your models. So that when you look at a spectra that maybe has some damped features or things that maybe don't look quite right, you could attribute that potentially to a cloud.
That's something I didn't even think about now, because I can imagine that, because I know there was that day one when all of the images came back from James Webb, there was like all of these amazing things. And then there was a spectra from an exoplanet. And it kind of got left to the side a little bit. But one thing I certainly never considered is that when you're looking at the atmosphere and stuff, the atmosphere and what you're looking at isn't uniform. It isn't just equal all around. And these damn clouds would be leaving you with some really dense areas where it's just extremely concentrated. And how you account for that must be
It is.
I can't even. Oh yeah, we just looked at this damn planet going around a star millions of light years away, and oh, why is your data bad? It was raining. You know, like how do we happened to point it at a time that there was just a cloud, and trying to like, oh, I don't even know how you approach that, because it's so complicated. And I suppose that's exactly what you're doing. It's to actually bring that in. And you mentioned a phrase there, which I didn't quite get, but you said like, if you're looking at the spectra and you see a dampening effect or something like that, did you mention? And would that be like something you were expecting is there, but which is blocked? And would that be something that would occur because of a cloud, for example?
Yes. So for example, if you had, say you were looking at an atmosphere that had oxygen, you would expect there to be peaks in that spectra at particular wavelengths, and the physicists and the chemists will have a better idea of exactly what wavelength those peaks occur at. But if there had been a cloud sort of masking the atmosphere, those peaks, you still might get a glimpse of them if you know the light penetrated through the cloud enough and came back to the telescope. You might get what we call a dampened feature, which is just, it's just not as sharp or not as prominent as it should be. So you often would see dampening of features if there was a cloud. So they're just not as prominent as you would think. But sometimes if the cloud's thick enough, you don't get any features at all. That's when you're in big trouble.
And all of this now, all of this work digging into exactly what the huge benefit of looking at these clouds are, is it trying to see what does an average planet in the universe look like as opposed to what we are? I'm not going to throw you under the bus and be like, are there aliens, Dr. Rooney? Are there? Even though I suppose there is a little bit of, there's always, I think, maybe it's just a part of humanity to think that human life and life here is so special and unique because we haven't seen it elsewhere. But is genuinely a part of what you're doing, seeing if you look across the planets around all the stars and the Milky Way and stuff like that, what does the typical rocky planet look like? And then trying to compare that to what we're like. Is there a little bit of that going on?
It's not even so much what does a typical planet look like. It is about discovering what's the most prevalent planet, what type of planets form most often, what kind of planets form around different stars. One thing that still sort of is in question and is interesting to scientists is how solar systems form, or you know, planetary systems form and their positions, and having a look at different planetary systems gives us insight into this. You know, we have our own solar system, but lots of other stars will have a number of planets orbiting them. But primarily it's just to discover what's out there and get a greater understanding of the universe, how it formed in general. But yeah, search for life, try and see, you know, where you're always looking for water, liquid water, different things that we understand to be components of life or necessary for life to exist. Now, this is life as we know it. There could always be a different form of life that we haven't seen yet, that we don't understand yet, that could exist without liquid water. But as far as we're concerned, you need certain things in order for life to exist. So you always, there'll be the odd headline that'll say, you know, super Earth discovered, or Earth-like planet discovered, most potential for harboring life, things like that. That is an interest to scientists, is can we find something that's like Earth? What's the closest planet out there to Earth? Because that could be somewhere that there could be another form of life.
That's so interesting. It's so interesting that that's actually happening as opposed to the tinfoil hat I have on. It is wonderful and it's so interesting. And I can imagine there'd also be a lot of interest in the distribution of different elements in the universe and trying to like see, maybe identifying, wow, there is a lot of element X on this planet. How did that happen? That's unusual. Yeah. And is there a lot of that going on as well, where you just
see these
outliers and it leads to obviously more questions and people have to actually answer, how did that happen?
Yeah, exactly. And there'll be discoveries of planets that are bigger than they should be, orbiting a star closer than they should be, or vice versa. Stars that are very, or planets that are huge and really bright that are very far away from their sun or their star. And so there's still, as we discover more planets and as they're getting analyzed and we get better data, scientists are just discovering more and more things that are making them change the way they understood the universe to operate and for planets to behave. And, you know, there's so many different things that goes in. You know, you're observing a planet at a moment in time, which is really like years and years and years ago. By the time it reaches our telescopes, we're looking at how it appeared many years in the past. So you're kind of learning about something that's probably not like that anymore. And many things can happen. What I've always loved about it is that it's just so vast. You know, there's so much to discover and there's so many different components of it that are important. You've got the chemistry, you've got the physics, you've got all of the unknowns in terms of dark matter. And there's just, if anybody's curious in any way, there's something in space that would fascinate them and they could work on and they could discover. Because sometimes, you know, we've got Google, there's so many things that you just get the answer for instantly now. It's very, you don't spend a lot of time thinking and trying to work things out. But when it comes to space, you do, because there's so much we don't know. So I just think it's such a great way to really explore science, to think through difficult problems, to think outside the box and to be curious.
Yeah, no, I really identify with that. And like you were giving me very, like when I was younger, I had the exact same thought where it was just that sheer curiosity. I just knew I liked science and that I was just, my top two things on the CAO was like astrophysics in Galway and then neuroscience in Cork. Because in my head, I was like, I just want to go somewhere where we don't know what's going on. And I ended up not getting astrophysics and ending up in neuroscience. No. I didn't get neuroscience, but I was getting astrophysics, but then I got in through like access route and I was like, sweet, this is fantastic. So, but when you're hitting that, it hits such a, like, there's like the 18-year-old, the guy who romanticized science long before his PhD started. And, you know, yeah. And I'm just like, oh, that's so wonderful. And it's so true. And I adore that about space. And like you said, that vastness, that idea that it's so vast that so much is possible. And mm-hmm. the fact that you're actually working on a team that's observing some of these wild outliers and you're left just gobsmacked of this doesn't make sense. And I'm sure that you would also face a problem sometimes where you would make a fantastic model. But the problem is the universe is so big that the fantastic model's 1% chance of something going wrong, you'll find it. Yeah. You'll find that time that happened and you'll have to make the decision of, does that mean the model is wrong? Probably. It might not. It might be very, very good, except it's just the universe is so big. You found that time.
Yeah.
That time something swung off into infinity. And it's just, it must be absolutely mind bending. The next thing that comes to mind that I'm curious about is, you said there was like a huge influx of data and there was more data than you had models. And where would you be getting a lot of your data from? Would it be from like telescopes in space or telescopes on land, or where would a lot of the data that you're feeding into your models be coming from?
So the data that we work, so the models I'm currently developing are still very much in development. So I sort of am working on a very limited number of data sets that I think they were space telescopes. I want to say they were from I'm not sure exactly which telescope, but I'm pretty sure they were space telescopes. They are... They're very much like the test case that I've just sort of systematically run for 2 years. And I suppose I've become a bit in the big picture. Yeah. And I talk about the data and I talk about the planets. But then really my day to day is just sitting in front of my computer with a code trying to figure out why I've got this one peak where it shouldn't be. So you kind of forget at the end of the day, I'm screaming at this data when really I'm not thinking about that it came from space.
Isn't that the reality? Exactly what I was just saying of the, like, I love, and it's so important to hold on to that romantic side. And like, yeah. I love what I'm doing. I love what I'm doing. But I'm the same. I spend most of my time at my desk staring at a massive Excel sheet or MATLAB sheet or something like that, working on massive data sets. And it's so detached from that, even though it's so important. You know, you are working with real things. Like I'm working with real biological data. You're working with a lot of real data of things that exist. And the day-to-day moments of tap, 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 tap. Why is there an error? Fix the error. Tap, tap. Why is there a new? It is a separation in science. Mm-hmm. And I think since we speak so much about the romantic side of science, people often forget that they're just jobs. Like, they don't televise everyone in the office just like, tap, tap, tap. Or the 2 years of work that goes like it, for example, before a launch. At launch day for anything, everything looks like a movie and it's so exciting and everyone's so happy. There was 2 years of pain before that. You know, there were decades of people sitting in offices, scratching their head and slowly losing hair, you know.
I
think that's just such a huge, huge part of science, which I think people like forget an awful lot. It happens as well. I know I'm on a little ramble now, but it does happen as well whenever someone in like biology, for example, or medicine would publish a new article.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And it could be purely based on data. They would say a newspaper will come in and be like, go in, throw on a lab coat and put something into a tube. And it's like, these are people who haven't seen the inside of a lab in a decade. You know, it's just to feed the image that's in the discourse of this is what it looks like. And it's
to
just,
be a scientist. I know if I ever get asked, what's a day in the life? Like, I don't know if you really want to know, but a typical day in the life is like, make a cup of tea, sit at my desk, do some coding. Have my lunch.
Yeah, I'm sure people have an image of you arguing with physicists in front of a blackboard going, no, it's like this. This is how it really should be. Oh, I can only imagine. And that is a part, that's something we didn't quite touch on. Is it? I read before, but you're the only mathematician on a team of physicists. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how does that play together? Like, how does your role intermingle with their role, for example, on the team?
So my role initially, I was brought in to try and improve existing models. So there is, my research team had a model for clouds and a model for general radiative transfer. And both of these are relatively old and they had been previously written in Fortran and then converted to Python. So the capabilities of the packages and the different sort of numerical capabilities we have now with the programming language of Python, these codes weren't really utilizing any of that yet because they had been just transcribed essentially from this other programming language. So I was brought in to try and improve these models. Their main selling point was that they're very, very fast. So you can get results. So I spoke a bit earlier about the more detail you include and the more intricacies, these models become slow and they can become so slow that they're just not useful. So the models that I've been working on, they're accurate, but they're very quick. So they wanted to maintain that. They wanted to keep that sort of quickness, the efficiency of the models, but wanted a bit more flexibility of the models. You can, you know, have a few more parameters, be able to handle a more diverse environment that you're trying to model. So I was sort of relying on their physics and their sort of scientific guidance to say, this is the important components. This is what we need to capture. This is where we're limited. And then I was coming in with the maths, try and be like, right, well, let's see if we can incorporate that in the model in this way, or can we add this bit of detail but keep the speed down in this way? So it's worked well. It has been challenging with the pandemic and with me primarily being in Ireland, because there's an 8-hour time difference. So when I'm relying on a physicist to tell me if this parameter should be 1.5 or 8, I'm waiting a long time. And then quite often by the time they've got a moment to get back to me, my working day is over. So it's been slow trying to make collaborative progress sometimes, but ultimately the team I've worked with have been excellent in, they've let me work my own hours for a start, which was huge, because if I had to work California hours, I would be a recluse even more so than we all were during the pandemic. So there's a lot of back and forth, a bit of here's the physics, and then me coming back with, okay, I've done some maths. Is this something that you think works? And so it's been great. I've learned so much as well, which is kind of what I love to do. I love taking maths and applying it in areas that is maybe a bit new or it's not my specialty, and kind of learning. I know so much about clouds and about radiative transfer, things I never would have known otherwise. So it's been great.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, that's so interesting just to see how it all fits together. And yeah, makes total sense that you're there to actually make the model good. And you do have to lean on other people to kind of get that importance factor in. But that's teamwork. That's how that goes, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose, like you were saying there, you love that learning and all of that stuff. But like, what do you think is, where do you think you'll go next? Do you think, like, obviously you're very happy where you are. Obviously this is all going amazing. But like, I've seen, for example, and I know you launched it a while ago, but I saw the science communication project and you're doing loads of really good videos and stuff like that, like communicating maths, which is just A1. And do you think are you going to keep that project going? And do you think that, like, well, first, yeah, we'll talk about that project first before we go into anything else that you might be thinking about down the line.
It's Mathematicals, play on Mathematical, but Mathematicals. So the initiative was set up by myself and another maths PhD student, Jessica Williams. We both did our PhDs together at Oxford, and then we were sort of both motivated to do something to encourage and to showcase women in maths, because I mean, there's not enough women in maths, but the women in maths that are there, people just don't know them. If you think about famous mathematicians or famous scientists in general, it's always men that come to mind. We think that that is pretty detrimental for getting more girls interested in science and girls interested in maths. So that was sort of where the initiative stemmed from, was this promotion of women and encouraging of girls to pursue careers in maths. So we founded Mathematicals to try and combat this. And we try and combat three things. The first is we want to try and make maths fun, because that's definitely something that I don't think it's world renowned for being the most fun subject at school. A lot of people did not like maths and claim that they are no good at maths. And we think that all just comes down to they never really connected with the subject in school, which we understand. We understand why that happened. But we think that we can present maths in a way that's a bit more fun, a bit more accessible, and will hopefully engage not only kids, but just the general public. We want to get more girls interested in maths, and we want to showcase all the women in maths. So that's the sort of three things that we're trying to do. So we make videos, we try and share little mathematical quirks and curiosities and things that we think might spark people's interest. But ultimately, we are hoping to grow that and to actually reach out a bit more directly to girls, to students, to schools, to teachers, to anyone that we think could make an impact to try and get more girls into maths and just make maths a bit more fun in general.
Yeah, and it's such a good initiative as well, because especially for the cohort that your videos and stuff will be targeting, people in schools, that's where this kind of leaky pipe begins. Because I've heard stories as well of like all girls school where the school doesn't prioritize making sure that there's physics teachers and like honors maths teachers and multiple honors maths teachers to expand classes and applied maths as well, because it's not typical. But that's totally missing the point.
Yeah.
And there is so much truth when you think about like famous physicists or mathematicians or things like that, you think of men. And so much of that must tie into where this leaky pipe is coming from. So I think that work that you're doing, just have the exposure out there that girls could see it's happening. And like, you're such a fantastic example working at NASA, doing all of this amazing work through what can only be called such a fascinating route you've taken here to get where you are. It is fascinating by default, starting off where you're from and then going to Trinity and then to Oxford and into NASA. It's like, God knows what's up from here. Like, you're doing so fantastically. And it is super, super important. I hope that keeps going super well for you. And I hope that it does keep expanding. And hey, hit me up if there's ever anything, if you ever need any connections down where I am, let me know. And
brilliant.
Yeah, on that as well, to just keep thinking. Do you see anything else for you in your career that you'd like to hit with the mathematics? Stepping back into the research and scientist shoes, do you think that you have things on the career bucket list that you'd still try to pursue?
Yeah, definitely. There's two sort of main things I would love to do. One of them is to contribute more directly to a space mission. So be that a satellite or a rocket launch or anything that's, I did a summer school at JPL, the NASA JPL lab, and we worked on designing a planetary mission to Enceladus within our solar system to look for signs of life. So this was all conceptual, but that whole process of actually designing the probe that we're going to send, the instruments, the science it's going to do, it was fascinating. So to be able to contribute to something like that, that you would get to see go to space, is definitely something I would love to do. Better still, if I could combine that goal with my other one, I would love to just do something to kind of try and combat the climate crisis. So if there's, you know, through space missions, I think this is a massive area. You know, we've got so much Earth observation capabilities now, so many things that can be done from space, and the advantages that we gain from sending satellites and different things into orbit. So I think if I worked on a space mission that was combating climate crisis, perfect. But alongside a space mission, trying to do something that's going to improve our future, you know, and try and tackle this massive emergency that we're facing in terms of the climate crisis and sustainable living and all sorts of things like that. So when it's time to move on from NASA, those are the sort of things I'm going to be focusing on trying to move into.
Well, I'm damn glad. I'm glad you're thinking about like the climate crisis and stuff like that, because from everything I'm hearing, you're the right person for the job. Gosh, do we need people passionate about it, looking at that and everything. Well, Dr. Rooney, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You're a fascinating person to talk to about the story and the ambitions and everything you've done. And it's just so interesting, successful, and so easy to talk to and listen to as well. So I really, really, really appreciate you being on the podcast. And when you're launching rockets, I'll be in contact again.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
This is the end of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed your time. If you're feeling generous and you're not completely skint, why don't you give us some of your money? Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon. Join our Patreon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.